From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. This Martin Luther King Jr. Day is the deadline that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer had set to change how the filibuster works and pass a voting rights bill. Did not happen. But before we get to that, we mark another milestone on this holiday. The late writer and poet Maya Angelou has become the first Black woman to have her image displayed on an American quarter. Here she is, reading at the inauguration of President Clinton in 1993.
A rock, a river, a tree, hosts to species long since departed, marked the mastodon, the dinosaur, who left dry tokens of their sojourn here on our planet floor.
The bill to commemorate women pioneers, including Angelou, was sponsored by Congresswoman Barbara Lee, Democrat of California. And she joins us. Welcome.
Thank you, Scott. Nice being with you.
Yeah, and your thoughts on the significance of this. I just reread a section of Maya Angelou's book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and she writes that growing up a Southern Black girl is the rust on the razor that threatens the throat. Wow.
Dr. Angelou, she was a phenomenal woman. And it is so important that the history of women in American history be told. So this goes back to 2017 when I worked with then Treasurer Rosie Reeves to develop legislation to do just that.
Now, this is part of a broader program, as you're describing, to honor other women pioneers, including Sally Ride and other women historically who fought for suffrage. But we, of course, know we still have racial animosity in this country. So in this moment, how does a coin, how does the symbolism of a coin help?
Well, it helps quite a bit because it's not only a symbolism. This is about lifting up these phenomenal women and their stories and their legacies and the barriers and the challenges that they really broke through. And I'm reflecting now today on Dr. Angelou's relationship with Dr. King. You know, she actually headed up the Northern Division of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference for Dr. King. She was very involved in the civil rights movement. And actually, her birthday is April 4th, the day Dr. King was assassinated. And for 30 years, she did not celebrate her birthday, but she and Mrs. Coretta Scott King were in touch on that day. Mm. You know, stories like this, beginning with Dr. Angelou, are so important for our young people, for everyone, but especially for girls, for women of color, for people who really have not gotten a chance to learn about women's roles in history and what, in fact, we have accomplished to make this country greater.
Hmm. Now, Maya Angelou's image is going to be on the tail side of the quarter, where it also says, E pluribus unum, right? From many, one.
One.
And of course, that is still an aspiration to many in the country. There are still a lot of challenges in this country. And many on your side of the aisle fear that state voting changes will end up disenfranchising many. The bill is now stalled in the Senate. So what happens now?
Well, you know, this is a fundamental issue as it relates to our democracy, which, again, Maya Angelou fought for. This is about voter suppression. It's about denying access to the ballot box. It's about denying the constitutional right to vote to millions of people, specifically African Americans, people of color, young people, women, people who live in rural communities, the disabled. It's very sinister what's taking place. And so this week, hopefully, Senator Schumer, as he said, will follow through and call the roll. It's time to call the roll. It's time to find out whose side these senators are on. And I'm talking about Republicans and Democrats. This should be bipartisan. With regard to Senator Manchin, you know, he actually helped write the Freedom to Vote Act when we passed it through the House and worked with Republicans to reshape the bill and to rewrite the bill. And so this is a bill that hopefully he can bring Republicans to support because he asked that it be rewritten in a way that he thought he could bring Republicans to support it. Mm. So short of that, I hope he and Senator Sinema will reconsider their position.
Well, Congresswoman, I think we have an idea what that tally is going to be if that bill doesn't move forward in its current iteration, what then?
Well, I'm not giving up hope. We have to keep fighting and keep moving forward. I'm cautiously optimistic, of course, that we'll get through this this week. But if we don't, given what the senators have said, we're going to keep at it. And the people who are in the streets, people who are protesting, that's how it's going to get done. People have to hold their members of Congress accountable. And this is about political will, and it's about making sure that those who we elect stand up for those who deserve to have their constitutional rights protected by their representatives.
Barbara Lee is a Democrat of California. Congresswoman, thank you for the time.
My pleasure. Nice being with you.
And there are four other women whose faces will go on American Quarters. Sally Ride, the astronaut. Wilma Mankiller, first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. Nina Otero Warren, a leader of the suffrage movement in New Mexico. And Anna Mae Wong, the early Chinese-American film star. You can read more about the program at hereandnow.org.
UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is reportedly planning to scrap requirements that require people self-isolate after catching COVID-19. This news comes amid an ongoing scandal that threatens his leadership of the Conservative Party. That problem has to do with another kind of party, the kind that members of his government, and at least in one case, the Prime Minister himself, attended when such gatherings were banned. NPR London correspondent Frank Langford is here. And Frank, what do you make of the timing of Boris Johnson's reported plans to repeal the self-isolation mandate?
Yeah, I think the timing is very interesting. I have to say that Omicron, we've had a big surge here, but it has not had the impact in terms of overwhelming lots of hospitals or with large numbers of deaths. And a lot of that probably has to do with very, very high a vaccination rate. So there was expected that Johnson would try to do something along these lines. And certainly most political analysts here think that this is a bid to try to save his job. This will be very popular among some of his most conservative backbenchers who always felt that the government went too far. Boris Johnson is in survival mode, and this may be one of the things he's doing to try to stay in office.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about his political position. We know that Johnson came to power in a landslide election 2 years ago. He's also survived many political scandals over the years. What makes this one different?
You're exactly right, Danya. He is the most Teflon of British politicians. Just a couple of examples. He has been caught out on extramarital affairs. He lost one of his jobs with the government when he lied about it. He also lost his newspaper job for making up a quote. But what I think makes this different is the stakes are so high. You know, we're talking about life and death. We're talking about people who followed the rules and weren't allowed to say goodbye to their family members. And the image that keeps coming out is the sense that Johnson and, you know, members of his staff at number 10 Downing Street felt that they were above the rules that they themselves had set. And I think he's found himself, not for the first time, the subject of ridicule. Here is a videotape of a bunch of protesters who are best dressed up like Boris Johnson. They're wearing blonde wigs. They have Boris Johnson masks on. And they're standing out in front of the gates of number 10 Downing Street.
Boris loves a party!
Boris loves a party! La 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 la! La 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 la!
Frank, the thing, though, is that these parties happened almost a year ago. Why are we hearing about them now?
Yeah, they go back even further than that, and that's another terrific question. Most people here think that somebody inside, maybe a former advisor or a number of people, really have it out for Boris Johnson, and they have been very strategically leaking it to the newspapers. And Johnson has been taking many, many hits. It's been very hard for him. And the feeling is that somebody wants him to be forced to step down.
Mm-hmm. How has he responded to this scandal?
Yeah, well, initially he said, oh, all the rules were followed. We didn't do anything wrong. And the problem is there have been more and more evidence that that's not the case. A really good example was photographs came out that someone had been sitting on for, I think, more than a year, of him in the back garden of number 10 Downing Street with wine and cheese on the table and lots of people drinking at a time when this was completely not allowed. The denial approach definitely is not working. Another thing that he's done is he's gone after the BBC. There's a move afoot to end what's called the licensing fee. But the BBC is someplace that particularly conservative voters in rural parts of the United Kingdom think is too far to the left. Just saying that he's going to try to do this may be very popular with them.
Oh, well, there's a lot to watch for sure. Before I let you go, I want to ask you about another big story we're following. British police arrested two people last night in connection with the British citizen who held a Texas synagogue hostage this past Saturday. What's the latest on that?
Well, the man who died at the synagogue who took the hostages, his name was Malik Faisal Akram. He was 44 from Blackburn in the northwest of England. And these two teenagers were picked up in South Manchester last night. And the thought is they must have some connection to this man. And we don't know the names of these teenagers who were picked up or what exactly police want with them.
That's NPR London correspondent Frank Lankford. As always, thank you so much.
Great to talk, Tanya.
Today we celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King, but we also want to draw attention to his mother, Alberta. Her story is one of those told in the book, The Three Mothers, which reframes historical moments about some of the most iconic civil rights leaders through the eyes of their mothers. Author Anna Malaika Tubbs makes the case that knowing these stories helps us better understand America. The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation, is now out on paperback. The book was published last February, and Anna Malaika Tubbs joined us by Skype to talk about it. And she started by talking about the context in which these women lived.
When I started the research, I first went to the books that were about the men. That was kind of my starting point. And I quickly realized that the parts of their life that were the least documented were before they met their husbands and before they had their sons. So before in history, where this man makes them important. And so I spent really a lot of time finding this historic context, really weaving together the details of all the different places where they came from and the places that they lived and what they cared about. Each of these moments would influence them differently based off of their own access to resources, their own education levels, Jim Crow laws, two world wars, the Cold War. I wanted us to explore Black history and American history through the eyes of Black women, Black girls, Black mothers.
Well, let's talk about these mothers individually. Let's start with Louise Little, Malcolm X's mother. She was born in Grenada, met Malcolm's father in Canada. They traveled the country teaching the Marcus Garvey Doctrine of Black Independence. But yes, after Malcolm's father was killed, Louise was deemed unfit to care for her children, and she was sent to a mental institution for 25 years of her life.
She is constantly the victim of these racist attacks, and it's not by coincidence. A big part of it is that she's very outspoken. She is this radical activist even before she meets her husband. And even after her husband passes, she wants to stay involved. She wants to provide for her children on her own, but she's not given the life insurance money that she deserves. She also then faces what many women of color over the years have spoken about, which is the invasive nature of welfare workers and this feeling that you're being judged when you're receiving the aid and the care that you're supposed to have available to you. And so there's a white male doctor who is instrumental in sending her to the institution, and I include the letter verbatim in the book where he says she's maladjusted, she's had a change in personality. He judges her for having her eighth child, and he ends by saying, quote unquote, that she's imagining being discriminated against. The craziness of saying about a Black woman from a white man that she's imagining being discriminated against, but this is enough to put her away for 25 years of her life because her family members were all her children. So they were too young to be able to advocate for her. Therefore, again, she's put away against her will.
I want to talk with you about Burtis Baldwin, the mother of James Baldwin. And we learned that these two were extremely close in your book. One educator at James's school when he was a child actually commented that Burtis's beautiful use of language, they all understood that James Baldwin got that from his mother. Your telling of Burtis's story, in a way, gives us a fuller picture of the world that James Baldwin shared with us through his writing. I mean, it actually helps complete the picture.
Yes, and that's what I want to accomplish with the book. I have a lot of goals for the book. That's definitely one of them, is that we have a fuller appreciation of these men. It's not to say that we need to erase the men, but when we do erase the mothers and we leave them out of the story, we don't fully understand how these men came to be who they were and how they changed our world for the better. And each of these sons credited their moms. There's letters and quotes from them where they say, it's because of my mom that I was able to do this. And I would say the clearest example of that comes with James Baldwin. Even when he passes away, his kind of dying wish is that he has a grave next to him. It's a double plot where his mother will join him when she passes. She has eight other children. But when he dies, he knows that people are going to want to come and see his grave. And they're going to know that his mother is interconnected with him, that they are inextricable from each other's lives. He was well aware of it. And it's just time that the rest of the world is, too.
Anna, we also get glimpses of Malcolm and James and Martin through a mother's eyes. One story that tickled me was of a little Martin begging his mother to allow him to go to school when he wasn't even old enough yet.
I love that story as well. I think it's so cute and how she, you know, actually agrees that she'll do this for him. And it takes a teacher noticing that he's too young and sending him home. But how he carries forward this feeling that my mom believed in me and that's all he really needed. With Malcolm X, one of my favorite stories is how much he loved growing peas. A big part of being this Marcus Garvey follower is that you believe in self-sufficiency. And so Louise and Earl taught their children how to hunt and plant their own food. And Malcolm speaks to growing his peas and then laying on the ground next to them and dreaming of his future, just staring at the sky. And I just find that to be so beautiful. And then with James Baldwin, I just picture him with each of his siblings, you know, he's helping to take care of them and he sees himself as his mother's right-hand man because he really has this deep resentment of his stepfather who is abusive towards him, abusive towards his mother. And he decides that in order to help her through that, he's just going to be by her side. And you just see with these three boys, their love for their moms, their dependence on their moms, as well as their mom's ability to be honest and vulnerable with their sons as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about Alberta King, MLK's mother. She was raised in Atlanta. Her father was a preacher. Before marriage, we learned that she wanted to become a teacher, but laws prevented married women from teaching.
Yeah, terrible.
Yeah, I mean, that is what I mean by the context that you give in this book. We learn about the time that they were living in. Here's a clip from radio reporter Eleanor Fisher's 1961 interview with MLK, where he's talking about the role of the Black mother in America, including his own. Let's listen.
It seems to me that the only thing that the mother can do, the Negro mother, is try from the beginning to instill in the child a sense of somebody-ness. This was what my mother tried to do. She made it very clear that in spite of these conditions, you are as good as anybody else, and you must not feel that you are not.
I mean, Anna, it's almost like that's the full-time job of a Black mother. But we learned from your book that throughout his life, Martin consulted with his mother on just about everything. And one of the most horrific parts of her story is that she was deeply afraid her son would be killed. And Martin really didn't try to protect her from that possibility. Can you read the excerpt of when King went to his mother to have this conversation about death?
Okay. After dinner at the King household one night, as they sat on their patio and watched the sunset, Martin turned toward Alberta and said, "Mother, there are some things I want you to know." He continued, "There's a chance, Mother, that someone is going to try to kill me, and it could happen without any warning at all. But I don't want you to worry over any of this." He came closer to her side. "I have to go on with my work, no matter what happens now, because my involvement is too complete to stop."
Anna, it's a sobering fact that all three of these mothers outlived their sons.
Yes, and it's the tragedy that we know and start the book with, and then you see their lives develop. And it's all a part of painting their humanity so that we feel it, so that we cry in ways that we might not have in just hearing of the history.
Was that the case for you? I know that you're a new mother.
Personally, that chapter, obviously, where I talk about the sons all passing away, I had to distance myself from it. As much as I felt connected to their three stories, I also felt inspired by their ability to not give up, to know that in this country, their children were going to be viewed differently. And I'm well aware of that for my own child. But they were also so clear that they were going to be part of that change and that their children were going to help transform systems around them. I see it as something that we need to stop looking at as some kind of inevitable lot for Black women to carry, as if we're supernatural and can stand more pain than other people. I want this book to be about changing that circumstance. What are the policies that we can put in place to make sure that we're on a different trajectory and we can reduce the loss in our Black communities?
Anna, recently we re-aired a conversation my colleague Michelle Martin had with the late Cicely Tyson, and Tyson told her a story about her role in the movie Sounder. It was a story about a Black family and their love for each other. And Tyson says during a press junket, she heard that a lot of white people didn't know Black children called their parents mommy and daddy. Do you think at the root, this kind of mythology is why it's only now that we're examining the lives of women like this?
We have to reckon with the fact over and over again that this country was built by slaves, and it was built by saying that we Black people were not people. We were property. You know, Black mothers in America are the only ones who have legally been deemed the givers of property. When we can confront that dehumanizing treatment, when we can confront how that is playing a role in mass incarceration, in the Black maternal health crisis, and so much more, that's when we're able to move forward and say, what can we put in place to recognize humanity? That's where it all comes back to. I do hope my book contributes to that. It's about more people recognizing who we are as human beings.
Anna Malaika Tubbs, her new book is The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. Anna, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate the support.
We spoke with Anna Malaika Tubbs last February. An underwater volcano in the South Pacific has erupted for the third time in 4 days. And the eruption on Saturday was among the biggest in decades. It caused a tsunami on Tonga's largest island with waves up to 4 feet, as well as a cloud of ash that covered the area in volcanic dust. Tsunami waves were also seen thousands of miles away in Japan, New Zealand, California, and Alaska. Dave Snyder is the Tsunami Warning Coordinator for the National Weather Service's Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer, Alaska, and joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yes, Dave, first off, help us understand the scale of this devastation. It looks like Tonga was the hardest hit. What can you tell us about the people and how they're faring there?
You know, I don't have a lot of information about exactly what's going on in Tonga. From the pictures that we've seen on the satellite, it looks like it was a significant eruption and one that might be historical in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. You reported tsunami waves in parts of Alaska and along the western U.S. coast. What did you observe from your vantage point?
We saw a very long event play out across the entire Pacific Ocean, and that speaks to how significant this eruption was. So much water was disturbed when the volcano exploded from underneath the water and disturbed the surface of the water that a ripple, a very large one, crossed the entire basin and affected nearly every continent touching the Pacific.
This volcano near Tonga erupts regularly, right? The last time was in December. But is there any way for scientists to predict when these eruptions will trigger tsunamis of the scale that we just saw over this weekend?
I don't know that we have enough information to predict a significant eruption like that. I'll leave that to the volcanologists. And we have some of those working with us at the Tsunami Warning Center as well. But what we're really watching for is a seismic-driven sea wave, something that is triggered from an earthquake. And that's what the Tsunami Warning Centers are designed to analyze and detect and warn for in under 5 minutes. Something mm-hmm. like this we detected through water level disturbances in that part of the world, our sister center in the Pacific, the Honolulu Center, the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center, started tracking that immediately, put up alerts for American Samoa, and that triggered our awareness to watch for those waves to move across the Pacific toward the U.S. West Coast and Canada.
The National Weather Service said that they have no record of the last time they had to issue a warning of this scale for that area. How unusual is it to see tsunami waves of that scale in the western U.S., I think 3 to 4 foot waves in parts of California?
Right. We have to go back to about 2015, I think, with a magnitude 8.3 earthquake in Chile. We saw 1-foot waves in California, and there was a tsunami advisory issued when that happened. In Chile, they saw about 15-foot waves. That was, again, 2015 in September. If we go back a little bit further in time, seismic events, Honshu, the 2011 earthquake in Japan, of course, produced waves on the West Coast, and a little further back, 2010, we saw a magnitude 8.8 once again in Chile. So those types of places on the planet and touching the coastal areas can send waves easily across the Pacific Ocean if the earthquake is strong enough. For a volcano, it's pretty unusual, and it will probably happen again, but it may not happen again in our lifetime.
Dave Snyder is the Tsunami Warning Coordinator for the National Weather Service's Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer, Alaska. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We are just weeks away from the Winter Olympics in China, where American skiers Michaela Schifrin and River Radamus will be going up against the world's best. Now, they grew up in Colorado ski towns, the product of an industry pioneered by World War II soldiers. Many were members of an elite mountain unit that fought German forces in the mountains of northern Italy. Here's a snippet of a documentary about them. It's called Climb to Glory.
The greatest blessing that came out of the 10th for many of us was the great common love of the mountains. And it became the lives of most of us.
These guys are not only war heroes, but to me, heroes in the ski industry.
So let's look back at the hallowed 10th Mountain Division with McKay Jenkins. He's author of The Last Ridge, the epic story of America's first mountain soldiers and the assault on Hitler's Europe. He teaches journalism and environmental humanities at the University of Delaware. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So take us to World War II in Europe, where Italy, Germany, Norway, they all had elite soldiers trained in the mountains. But what convinced the U.S. military to say, you know, we're going to do this too?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And Alpine Europe were well-versed in training mountain soldiers. They had fought in World War I in the mountains and had developed a lot of mountain soldiering techniques. But what Americans started to notice as the war began, before the U.S. ever got into it, they would be in movie houses in the United States looking at newsreels. So the United States found itself in the late 1930s and early 1940s one of the only major powers without any mountain troops or cold weather troops.
Mm. And I gather at this time, the training for these American Alpine units began in Washington State and in Colorado. Who were these men who got recruited?
The skiing industry at the time was very much in its infancy. Mostly the people who skied in the United States were in New England because skiing was not a developed sport. There were very few resorts. It was hard to get to the mountains. And so the people who could do it were generally fairly well-to-do, in this case, actually literally Ivy League students. So you would get on a ski train in, you know, outside of Yale or Boston and go up to the mountains and ski in Vermont. So you had skiers that were fledgling members of this new sport, this new industry. And then you had mountaineers out west. So a lot of the fledgling mountaineering was going on in places like Colorado and Wyoming and the Pacific Northwest. These guys were training outside of Vail, Colorado, at a brand new base called Camp Hale. And they were doing unprecedented training and gear testing. They were going up to 12,000 feet in winter conditions where it was, you know, 20 or 30 below zero, carrying 90 pounds of gear on their backs and testing the limits of human capacity and new technology. And they trained and they trained and they trained. And as the news media started to hear about these guys, they would send out photographers from Life magazine or they would send out film crews from Hollywood, and they took movies of these guys and put them on the covers of magazines, and they were very famous people, very famous soldiers before they ever actually saw any action.
All right, so by the time they eventually were deployed to Europe, where'd they go?
So it wasn't until very late in the war, way after the army was moving northward along the Italian boot, that they finally inserted them in northern Italy, right near what are known as the Apennine Mountains. This is a mountain range that is sort of southwest of the Alps. And they finally inserted them towards the very end of the war. There were just a matter of a few months left. But they needed to finally break through the defenses of the German army, which had been bleeding the Allied forces for years in Italy. It was one of the most bloody campaigns of the war.
Yeah, and just briefly, as we talk a little bit more about the war, there was one, I gather, treacherous climb under the cover of darkness that was a critical moment here, and you write about it in your book. Can you tell us about that?
So Riva Ridge was this ridgeline overlooking this very important valley in northern Italy, and the Germans were up on top in all of their bunkers and happily defending themselves without any trouble. And finally, when the 10th Mountain guys got there, they put about 750 soldiers at the bottom of this ridge and said, we need to knock these Germans off this outpost because we can't penetrate the valley without getting them out of the lookouts. So now you have 750 soldiers at the bottom of this ridge, and they were so outgunned and had such a disadvantage because they were at the bottom and the Germans were at the top that they were told that they had to take the ammunition out of their weapons. And they had to climb this ridge in the middle of the winter, in the middle of the night, and climb up this ridge and, you know, knock the Germans out in the morning, which they did. So 750 men climbed up with their weapons, got to the top. You know, the Germans are coming out of their bunkers all stretching and yawning and making their coffee, and suddenly they're finding themselves captured by these 10th Mountain guys. And what the soldiers found out later, and what historians know, is that the military predicted an 80% casualty rate during that climb.
Wow.
And in fact, there were zero casualties. They all made it to the top. It was really kind of a miraculous, exhibition of the training that they had been doing for so many years.
Now, after the war, veterans of the 10th Mountain Division, they founded places like Vail, Aspen, Lake Placid in New York, and Stowe in Vermont. Some of them designed cutting-edge ski equipment. I mean, what was the vision of key veterans of the 10th Mountain Division to develop skiing for the masses?
You know, these guys had grown up skiing or climbing in the mountains of New England, the mountains of the Pacific Northwest, the mountains of Colorado and Montana. And after the war, they went back home, and they had had so much fun, believe it or not, despite the war. They had had such a great experience with all this new technology and meeting all these great other athletes that they started trying to make a profession, make a life with this kind of thing. So they started the ski resorts in Aspen and Vail and Stowe, Lake Placid, places like that. But they also started very well-known mountaineering schools like the National Outdoor Leadership School. David Brower was the most important environmentalist of the middle 20th century. He ran the Sierra Club. They had the National Ski Patrol came out of this group. High Mountain Rescue came out of this group. Avalanche Science came out of this group. The U.S. Ski Team was coached by a veteran of this group. It's worth remembering that some of the founders of this division had actually come over from Europe because Americans, as I said, didn't really have a lot of experience skiing or mountaineering. So you had Swiss and Austrian and Norwegian world-famous gold medal winners coming over to join the forces in the U.S. to train them to go back to Europe and try to liberate Europe. So it was really quite an amazing international group of world-class athletes. And once they got out of the war, they laid down the foundation for what is now the entire U.S. ski industry.
And did this come, I guess, at the right moment in economic time after the war, when the middle class grew and people went on vacations and, you know, eventually they had interstate highways to get to ski resorts?
Yeah, that's a great point. Of course, the economic and physical structure of the landscape was changing rapidly too. So suddenly New England, you know, developed a ski industry because there were roads up there. And now lots more people had money. So you had middle-class skiers, not just elite, you know, Yale graduates skiing. So absolutely, that's for sure. On the other hand, if all that infrastructure had been laid down and there was no expertise to take advantage of it, probably none of this would have happened.
Well, you spoke with many of these men, many of the veterans from the 10th Mountain Division. Let's just play a little snippet from the documentary The Last Ridge, which is based on your book.
What ties together was a love for the outdoors, for the mountains.
We were tough. We were disciplined, I think. It's a hard word to use, but we were gentlemen. These were good guys.
And finally, McKay Jenkins, I guess, any final thoughts on how you reflect back on their legacy?
Yeah, I reflect back because the work that I do, which is looking at the history of the American landscape and how it came to be, you know, runs through this group of people. Like, they really were the most highly educated unit in the American Army. As I mentioned before, they were highly trained in all these things. So their legacy of environmental conservation, their legacy of putting down a footprint on the ski industry and the mountaineering industry, the mountain rescue industry, it's very hard to go through the mountains of the United States and not see their fingerprints all over the place. And that's not a war legacy. That's a conservation legacy, which I'm really quite happy to know about.
McKay Jenkins is the author of The Last Ridge, the epic story of America's first mountain soldiers and the assault on Hitler's Europe. He teaches at the University of Delaware. McKay Jenkins, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great talking to you.
Betty White would have turned 100 years old today. The beloved comedic actress died on New Year's Eve, leaving behind a legacy of laughter for millions of Americans, including members of the LGBTQ community, many of whom cherished one of White's flagship shows, The Golden Girls. That includes Colorado Public Radio's Vic Vella, who is gay and shares this personal essay on a Golden Girls episode that deals with AIDS.
When the Golden Girls would talk about issues important to the gay community, they often would do so with typical hilarity, like when Dorothy tells Blanche that a friend of hers is a lesbian.
I mean, I've never known any personally, but isn't Danny Thomas one?
Not Lebanese, Blanche. Lesbian.
But just as often, the show addressed these complex social issues with grace and empathy, like when Blanche was struggling to accept her brother's marriage to another man and talked to Sophia about it.
Oh, look, I can accept the fact that he's gay, but why does he have to slip a ring on this guy's finger so the whole world will know?
Why did you marry George?
We loved each other. We wanted to make a lifetime commitment, wanted everybody to know.
That's what Doug and Clayton want, too.
It's moments like these that have long endeared gay audiences to the Golden Girls. Debuting in 1985, it was a show that was way ahead of its time when it came to LGBTQ representation on television. And there was one episode that stood out to me when I was a young gay boy in 1990. It was about AIDS, one that Betty White, who played the lovable Rose Nyland, handled with beautiful honesty. In the episode, Rose gets a letter from a hospital.
St. Luke's Hospital wants me to come in for some kind of test. That's where I had my gallbladder out 6 years ago.
Can I see it, Rose?
They throw organs out after surgery.
The letter, Rose.
Oh.
The letter states that the blood Rose received during a transfusion may have contained HIV antibodies.
Wait a minute. You're talking about AIDS. Oh, well, this has to be some kind of mistake.
Don't panic. There's just a possibility. This is a precaution.
Well, what do I do?
In 1990, an HIV diagnosis was often a death sentence. There was tremendous fear around AIDS at that time. Many people died alone in hospital beds because their families had abandoned them over the stigma of AIDS. Rose expresses that fear when she asks for a ride to the hospital to get tested.
But if you don't want to take me, I'll go without you. I might as well get used to being by myself.
What does that mean?
Well, come on. If that test turns out to be positive, you're not going to want to be around me.
So Rose gets tested for HIV. And the next 72 hours are torture while she waits for the results. That anxiety Rose was feeling is something I know a lot about. I'm HIV positive. And I'll never forget that day in 2006... when everything changed for me. Being gay and a heavy drug user at the time, I was at high risk of contracting the virus. And I was very sick when I got the results. Doctors told me that if I didn't start taking medications right away, I would develop full-blown AIDS. I thought I had failed morally, that because of my own debauchery, I somehow deserved this outcome. But leave it to the Golden Girls to set me straight, like when Blanche scolds Rose over having the same negative thoughts I had.
AIDS is not a bad person's disease, Rose. It is not God punishing people for their sins.
You're right, Blanche.
Well, you damn straight I'm right.
More than 30 years after this episode aired, the tools we use to fight HIV and AIDS have come a long way. Rose tested negative, but for those who don't, medications can now suppress the virus to the point where it's undetectable in your blood. I've been undetectable for 15 years now, and I'm grateful. But many still suffer, and the stigma remains.
Now, Rose, take it easy.
Why does everyone keep saying that? I don't feel like taking it easy. I might have AIDS, and it scares the hell out of me.
Looking back on this episode, its honesty at a time when society couldn't handle the truth around HIV still resonates today. And in typical Golden Girls fashion, they made some hard truths easier to swallow with a little laughter. Like when Rose asks Blanche how she handled getting tested for the virus.
Oh, God, this waiting is driving me crazy. Blanche, when you were tested, how did you make it through?
Just kept it to myself and acted like a real bitch to everybody else.
No wonder we never knew.
On behalf of millions of gay men affected by HIV, thank you, Betty White. We miss you. For Here and Now, I'm Vic Vella.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.